being raised in an alcoholic home, it was scary for me as a little kid. It was very scary. My parents fought a lot, and I think I learned to be very quiet, and we never wanted to upset Daddy because I never wanted the fights to start. And there were times when my dad would shove my mother out of the house and lock her out, and my mother would be screaming at us, my sister and I, to let her in, and my dad would say, no, you're not letting her in, and we would just be scared to death what to do. So it gave me this point of personal shame inside of me because I didn't know anybody else's parents who behaved the way my parents behaved. And the last thing my father said to me before the last time I saw him, he told me, don't tell anybody that I drank. So I carried those feelings about the shame of it inside of me. And I had a fear of really standing up for myself because I never wanted to say something that would upset somebody, that they would yell and scream at me like my father did when he was upset. So it really affects your adult relationships too. You carry that into your adult relationships. When I think about when I went through with my first husband, and I put up with a lot because I wanted my children to have what I didn't have. So when I met John, he was very sweet, very nice, and we started going out, and we just really had fun together. We were really just really good friends. But I noticed that he tended to drink quite a bit, and it bothered me just because of my background. I was very uncomfortable with it. And we dated off and on for over 3 years, and I finally said, I just can't deal with your drinking anymore. It makes me very uncomfortable. So we broke up. And he, after a while, we came back together, and he said he'd stop drinking. And I said, wow, that's wonderful. I'm really happy about that. So we decided to get married. But I waited for a year. I wanted to make sure that he had his sobriety, and he seemed to be doing great. So we got married, and after we were married for almost our first wedding anniversary, I found out that he was taking drugs from the clinic that I work for. I was called into my supervisor's office, and they said, your husband is coming in the mornings and taking drugs out of the clinic here. And I was totally, completely devastated. I was so hurt by it. It was just incredible. It was like somebody had just hit me in the chest. So I confronted him, we talked about it, and he said, I'll never do it again. I'll never do it again. I just hung in there hoping that it would work out and that he would get his sobriety. And of course he promised, I'll never do it again. I'll never do it again. I love you and I'll never do it again. And of course you want to believe him. You want to believe. That's what you want. You want the insanity to stop. And, it didn't.
Welcome to Unhooked. My name is Pastor Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Kitty, and today our topic is about enablers.
And I am really pleased to welcome Josh Beauchesne and Selena Schuler. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
I was wondering if you could just describe a little, what is an enabler? What does that look like? How do I know if I'm one or somebody else is one?
Well, I think the heart of enabling really is kind of like the word means. It's some sort of action that either accommodates or actually facilitates another person's destructive behavior at some level.
So why do they do it? Why do enablers allow for some of the behaviors to go on, even though they may be aware that this isn't good or healthy?
Well, I think there's like three big reasons, basically. I think people usually enable out of fear, guilt, and shame. And when those emotions are hit underneath, they don't recognize that they're either feeling afraid, guilty, or shameful. But instead, it comes out in this deep sense of like wanting to protect or care or love. And so the behavior, like when you are enabling, feels like you're actually supporting someone. But the reality is you're, again, either accommodating, tolerating, or actually facilitating someone else's destructive behavior or supporting it at some level.
Can you give us like a practical example of what that might look like? How is somebody doing that practically in someone's life?
Well, between maybe a spouse. So the husband, say he's the addict, and the wife would do things like lie for him, call in sick for work if he's been using that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Do children ever enable as well? Or?
Well, it's interesting because you learned it in Nadine's story, is what you see is this person that grew up in a family system that was already being asked, you know, even as a child, to really withhold what they were seeing accurately and to not, you know, call things as she saw it, and instead just internalize it and kind of pull herself in. And that pattern becomes the basic operating system, if you will, for someone that enables. Because now, even though she sees concerning behavior with her husband down the road, she's already been conditioned and trained to not say anything, to try to accommodate, to be dishonest, to lie, and support that system, and minimize her own sense of self.
So what impact does this have just down through the course of a person's life if it's never dealt with? I mean, how do they do life?
So for example, it sounds to me like, oh, you're being protective. You're trying to be helpful. You're doing the role of kind of caregiving in a way, it sounds like. So why is that wrong? Why would that be an impactful thing that might be negative?
It actually reinforces the behavior. So with a lot of the addicts that we work with, the parents or the spouses reinforce the behavior by supporting them financially, emotionally, in different ways that actually make the addict continue to use. Where when the families stop doing that at some level, it helps the addict come to grips with their recovery and get into treatment typically.
Yeah, I was going to say, is there a fine line between enabling and like actually helping someone? Where is that? Where are you helping someone, and then it's different from enabling someone? Because we do want to be there and support people and encourage them to get better, to stop negative behavior. But where does it become help and not enabling?
Helping would be actually adding to their treatment. So saying that, I love you, so I'm going to support you to go get treatment, to go to AA, to get a sponsor, do those types of things. But anything other than supporting treatment would actually be harmful. So reaching out, getting support, that type of a thing.
It sounds to me like there's a balance, so that in the balance must be support and nurture and love, but there's got to be accountability and belief that change can occur. So it sounds to me that the difficulty with enabling isn't that you're enabling health and well-being, but you might be enabling the addiction by those issues.
Yeah, and that's the mistake. I think when you see families that get into recovery and people begin to address their own enabling behaviors, a lot of times the reaction is kind of the pendulum swings all the way to the other side from being completely overly supportive into cutting off. And then they're kind of come across as really unloving and uncaring. And the balance in the middle is really this ability to recognize, what are the behaviors that I really want to support in this person and come alongside with and encourage as it relates to recovery and just living a full, healthy life, versus what are the behaviors that I'm going to take a stand and set boundaries and to say, I'm not willing to do this. And I think it's really important, instead of I can't, it's I'm not willing to. The statement of power, that I am significant enough to say, this doesn't work for me. And that's what someone that has enabling behaviors really struggles with. This idea to be able to say, hey, this doesn't work for me, is so scary for them because they catastrophize it. This person might reject me. Because again, when we're working with people in addiction, they come at you really strong. Lying, aggression, they push your buttons and make you feel or trigger your feelings of inadequacy pretty easily. And so our enabling is kind of like, okay, you do that. And instead, to be able to set boundaries, that this doesn't work for me, so therefore, here's what I'm willing to accept, and this is what I'm, you know, not willing to accept. It's that scary step that's so crucial, because it also asserts me in that process.
It sounds to me like what you're saying is that not only might the addict need some help with this, but the enabler, the spouse, whoever it is in their life, may also need some help understanding this as well in the treatment process. Is that true?
How do they know? How do they know that they're an enabler? I mean, what, you know, when does the light come on for this person?
If you're in a system with addiction, then if you're not the addict, then you're an enabler at some level. And it's really interesting because the more intelligent you are, the more sophisticated your enabling techniques are. And that's what's really hard. So even high functioning families that think, well, wow, we're, you know, 2.5 kids and we make over $100,000 a year. What's wrong with us? And it's those, you know, even you have progressive layers of enabling, and people have, you know, no matter what situation they come from, they struggle with enabling at some level.
So addiction does impact the broader system around the addict, and it sounds like there's so many different interplays there that are occurring and that need to be mindful in the treatment process. So we're going to go to a break now, and thank you so much.
When people would invite us out to go somewhere to do something with them, I would say, oh no, we have other plans, or we can't go, because I knew John was on a run with his drugs and that there was no way we could go out and be social with people. People would ask him to do things, do jobs for him, and I would cover up and say, well, he's really busy right now, so you know, we'll have to call you back when he's not so busy. And I would justify it to myself because John would have periods of sobriety. He would go 2 or 3 months and I would fall in love with him again and we would be good. Things would be great between us because when he wasn't using, we loved each other, we had fun together, we were good together. And then when he would go off on a run, I absolutely hated him. I just hated him. I hated what he was doing to us. I hated the way he was hurting us. I hated that what he was doing to our children, my children. I hated it. Well, I think the turning point for us in our relationship was when I came home and John was completely out of it on our couch, completely drugged up and just a mess. And I had invited some friends in. And I couldn't wake him up, and I just said, I was so embarrassed, I just said, you know, I'm sorry, he's not feeling well. I covered up for him, I made excuses, and they left. And I called some of his friends that he had gone to the NA meetings with, and they came over, and they offered John to go to rehab, and he chose it. So the rehab that he went into was a 90-day outpatient rehab, and I had to go with him because I was his codependent. That's when I learned that I was just as sick as he was, because I had to do my testimony and give my history, and I realized how I had covered up and lied and made it easy for him to do what he was doing, because I didn't just say, I'm not doing this anymore, and end it. I kept going along, and they actually show that in many ways the codependents are sicker than the addict in how you handle your life. And so it was very, very eye-opening for me to just be made aware of these things, these feelings that I was having, and that they were normal, that other people had them too. And of course I learned a great deal about myself and my codependency and how I had been from childhood raised to be a codependent. I just feel like a person who felt really good about who they were wouldn't do it. They wouldn't put up with it, where a codependent will. And they'll cover up, they'll lie, they'll do whatever it is to not embarrass that person. And you just sacrifice who you are by doing that.
Welcome back to Unhooked. So talk to us a little bit about treatment options for enablers. How do they learn to say no?
So we recommend individual therapy, family therapy, Al-Anon, some group therapy.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's as simple. So say someone is watching this show and they kind of see some of these vignettes and go, man, I think I have some of these patterns of maybe struggling with enabling in my family or with my partner or spouse or whoever it is, my child who's struggling with addiction. Mm-hmm. One of the first steps I think can be really helpful is to go grab, you know, some sort of reading material that maybe can help us make a little more sense of it. Even as simply as starting with a book, say, Codependent No More by Beattie, which is really common for someone that struggles with not being able to set boundaries because of their lack of sense of self. And so that's a great place to start, as simply as that.
Mm-hmm. And would you say, sometimes we talk about addicts being the last to know that they're being an addict. Is it sometimes we're the last to know if we're enabling as well?
Yeah, I think so.
Definitely. And I think that maybe getting a hold of an interventionist too, and maybe talking with some people outside of the system to get support and to figure out what areas in your life where you need help. So typically with interventionists or with maybe a mental health professional, they can assist you in the process of trying to understand your behaviors and how you're contributing to the system of addiction.
Yeah, it sounds to me like it could be a tough process because we talked about boundaries and how important they are. And sometimes that feels a little unloving, you know. And so, you know, I don't know, sometimes maybe encouraging them, what it might feel like to start putting boundaries in there? What does that feel like?
Yeah, and that's where a family, like family therapy, can be a great place, because you come in and it's really everyone's in an uncomfortable situation aside from the therapist, and you're able to be uncomfortable together and really kind of learn and grow and identify, hey, what is some of the dysfunction or the problems? What are the problems in the ways that we're communicating? What would boundary setting look like? What would my reaction be if someone set a boundary? And exploring that almost as an experiment can then begin to help us begin to make, you know, sustainable change in a family system.
That's your area of expertise, right? I think you're a licensed marriage and family therapist.
Correct, yeah.
So what have you seen as you've interacted with families? And has it been difficult for the enabler to begin to say no, to change, for the light to sort of come on and say, wow, man, what have I been doing? I've been enabling this bad behavior.
Yeah, I think it's really difficult because, again, when we're talking about addiction, it's a family disease. It's really not exclusive to the addict. And you see that the addict within the family system is getting all the attention. They garner the attention and the intensity, if you will, of the whole family system. But it's a system. All the parts are moving around and interacting with each other, and that's just a symptom. The addiction is a symptom of the family system. And so when you look at it that way, it helps everyone kind of move back from this place of blame. Because we talk about it, as soon as we find out, like, how, you're an addict? What did I do wrong? Boom, immediately, now we're going to try to use, you know, the system at some level to make me feel better as a parent or as a sibling, whatever it might be, a spouse, to absolve me from any responsibility or guilt. And so we want to move away from blame so that we minimize that reaction of, like, it's not my fault, I didn't mean to, into, like, hey, how is this all working together? And what role do I play, and how can I make some adjustments and so that we can collaborate together in a way to work through this?
It sounds like there's a, rather than a blaming, there's automatic responses that we've learned that are templates of, if somebody behaves this way, this is how, and it might not be healthy, but that the therapeutic process as a family might help to raise those to awareness and be able to change those reflexive ways of supporting things that are not healthy.
Break some old habits and change some.
Well, exactly. With that vignette of Nadine, you see again so clearly how she was already preconditioned to respond perfectly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, in some ways destructively to her spouse. Because here she started seeing these concerning behaviors, and she was already used to, like, oh, well, you know, boys will be boys or whatever. And then until it blew up completely, was she able to kind of make some stances?
I think about it in terms of also God, because we sometimes say, oh, you know, we just need to be loving, and, you know, the boundary thing is so hard. But in terms of, like, even from a Christian or a belief in God, is there support for understanding enabling in a different way?
You know, from my vantage point, you look at how Satan is this, you know, the prince of darkness.
Yeah.
And he comes like a thief. And so, you know, my idea is it's very seductive. And so often we get into poor bad patterns of behavior that really are destructive to us. And it doesn't ever feel, at the beginning of it, like they're destructive. It feels good. And so with enabling, we're reaching out to try to care, and yet we're doing the very, you know, what we feel is caring behaviors that are actually accommodating someone's addiction or you know, supporting them further into the addiction. And that is so vintage Satan, how he comes in at some level and is able to twist the truth so that it feels good, but yet wreaks such havoc on the lives of people there. And that's what he's after.
For sure. Is there a way that church people, faith communities can help people who are sort of stuck in this rut of enabling?
You know, for me, because this disease thrives on shame and isolation, that the first step, and this is what we so counterintuitive, it's going to be very counterintuitive, but the first step we can take is to have dialogue. Mm-hmm. That's a discussion, being open to sit down with our friends or someone in our accountability group or our, you know, couples group, or sit down with our pastor or some of the counseling staff and say, something doesn't feel right here. Mm-hmm. And to begin that dialogue immediately opens the doors for us to begin to exact change.
And within the church system, too, I think it's important that they're educated about addiction. There's lots of shame within the church about what addiction's about, so it'd be hard for someone to come forward and say that I have a struggle with heroin abuse or something like that. So I think for the church to have an education of their pastors and the staff to understand about addiction and codependency.
Mm-hmm. And the church, what a great place of the model of God to show that love, but also that there's a different pathway, and I'm there to help with the accountability as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Good.
Hey, thanks so much. You guys were awesome, Josh and Selena. And Unhooked will be back in a little bit.
Out of all the people, the 25 people that were in our group, John is the only one still that still has his sobriety from going through that rehab together. So it was amazing. Out of it, we were able to fall in love again and cement our marriage back together. And that was 22 years ago. And we've had a really good, loving relationship since that happened. I know people look at us and go, well, they're such a cute, loving couple. How, they don't have any problems. They don't realize how much we went through together and how blessed we are today to be where we are. You know, I keep telling myself when I don't feel lovable that God loves me just the way I am. And it helps so much to know that he's our father. I mean, I lost my father so many years ago, but to know that I have the Heavenly Father that loves me dearly, I would not be where I am today. I would not have the peace inside my heart. I would not have the love inside my heart. You know, I'm just so grateful. Words cannot answer how grateful I am to be where I am today and to have John with me, to have a godly husband, and to share what we share. It's a huge blessing, a huge blessing. My name is Nadine, and I'm Unhooked.
We've learned in this segment, friends, that codependency and enabling can be just as destructive to the addict and to the family as the addiction itself. In fact, many people look at codependency as the basis or the substrate for all addictions. Friends, Nadine shared with us her own story of codependency, her own story of enabling, but she found that Jesus loved her. He loved her very deeply, and this was a healing revelation to her. My name is Dr. David, and one of the things that we have discovered in the treatment of addiction is that many addicts are really searching for God. You know, we know from the scriptures that God is love, and He has made us to be recipients of His love. But many times what happens is that in our search for love, we search in the wrong place. We search for love in alcohol or in drugs or in sex or in work or even in church sometimes. But there's this longing for God that only He can fill. friends. He wants to fill this longing in your heart today. He wants to do what only He can do. The enemy has led us to believe that we can be helped by looking at pornography or finding satisfaction in relationships with people or finding relief in drugs or in food. But those are addictive practices that are in the long run unsatisfying. And in the long run, they hurt us much more than they help. We think they help, but they really destroy the human person. God wants you to be free. He wants to be the one who heals you, who satisfies every longing of your heart. I know that He wants to satisfy you personally today and free you from the bondage that those old addictive practices have brought about in your life. Those things in the long run never work. They destroy. They lead us down the path that Satan has prepared for us. But God has freedom, freedom in Jesus, freedom in recovery. For more information about how you can break away from habits that hurt, contact Adventist Recovery Ministries. And for prayer, call 1-888-446-7388. Choose to become unhooked today.